Welcome to The Wrap Up, a weekly podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Sharon Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Joining me out of his sick bed and vacation is Daniel Goldblatt, our assistant managing editor. Welcome back.
Yeah, I playing injured, I threw my back out this week. It is a
likely story.
Terrible thing. It happened to me once before, and I learned that a lot like a migraine, like saying you hurt your back is way different than just you threw your back out. It's a completely different kind of pain. I've had to crawl to the bathroom yesterday. It's just been a rough day or two, but I'm mostly all the way back.
Are you on your knees by now?
No, I can walk, kind of. I walk a little.
You're on your feet. This is progress.
Yeah.
All right. Well, welcome back. So he's a trooper.
Thank you.
Here. So this week, you're going to get to hear my conversation with Cynthia Erivo, the star of Genius Aretha, which is in contention for this year's Emmys. Cynthia is really one of the most exciting talents to emerge in entertainment in recent years. And we went pretty deep in this interview. We talked about her mom leaving Nigeria to go to London with two small kids all on her own, and how Cynthia scaled the castle of the British establishment in entertainment when she applied and got into the Royal Academy of Drama, RADA.
Can't wait to hear that. I love Cynthia. But first, Sharon, Let's get into some headlines. You know, I think I've started this podcast probably at least twice in the last few weeks by saying, man, it was a rough week for the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. But guess what?
It was really rough.
It was a rough week for the Hollywood Foreign Press Association.
Correct.
Despite the fact they released its most comprehensive list of reforms to date, streamers, studios, and stars began to boycott the show, and it eventually culminated in NBC's decision to not air the 2022 Golden Globes. It's unclear what the HFPA will do this year and whether or not NBC is still on the hook for the $60 million it pays to air the show, but it seems very unlikely that we will get a Golden Globe ceremony in 2022. Sharon, what do you make of this latest move in this ongoing saga?
Well, for one thing, I feel pretty smart because we published a piece of mine on Monday morning that said, will the Golden Globes get canceled? And like 2 hours later, the Golden Globes got canceled. So I can be your resident expert, having covered this organization since 1996, since the year I got here to Hollywood. But anyway, There will be no Golden Globes ceremony in 2022. That's not up for question. The question is, would there be any reason that they would actually, decide on, vote on Golden Globe awards and issue a press release? I think they're unlikely to do that. But this really was where things were, the crashing climax things were sort of building toward over the past couple of weeks, when there's just been this intense pressure campaign by Time's Up, by Color of Change, by this group of 100 PR firms who have boycotted the press conferences going forward until they get what they want. And then what they started happening is that then Friday night, Netflix, and then Amazon, and then Monday morning, Warner Media all said they were going to boycott as well. So there really wasn't a lot of wiggle room. And in a way, NBC kind of hit the pressure valve, because it doesn't mean it's the end of the Golden Globes forever. It just gives them an extra year plus to implement these reforms. And I think they really want to do it, because I think they've finally gotten religion about the fact that this is the end of the organization as it was, and it needs to be a very different organization, or there will be no organization called the HFPA anymore.
Yeah, I feel like NBC really laid in the cut both rounds, right? When this first came out, NBC was one of the last people to say anything. They waited till everyone else sort of commented.
DCP, Dick Clark was even later, but yeah.
Yeah, anyway. And then this time around again, they just waited for everyone else. They sort of played it very, I guess, well, in that you'd like to see them get out in front of this thing. They never did that. They were always very reactionary. Which I guess that makes the most sense, because, as I said, they pay $60 million to air the show. It's a big deal for them.
It's a contractual sum. And we talked to a bunch of lawyers. I highly recommend those our listeners who are interested to take a look at Beatrice Verhoeven's piece about like what's next for the Golden Globes. She talked to a bunch of lawyers. Most of them seem to say, yes, it does depend on the contract, but probably they'll negotiate. I mean, that NBC is on the hook for that sum, but they'll probably negotiate some kind of middle ground.
Yeah, and I think it's curious if the HFPA then has the option to try and shop it somewhere else, and but who would,
they don't. No,
who would
they
even air it? Yeah, I would think not, but maybe that would
They do not. They do not negotiate. Have the right to air it somewhere else. No. And regardless, even if they did, which they don't, nobody's going to touch it. I think that was the quote, actually, one of the lawyers. No one will touch this with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah, why would you? It's a damaged goods, I think, at this point.
It's not even a matter of that. I mean, the Critics' Choice have already grabbed the Golden Globes
date. That was the funniest thing. Such good planning. They were like, oh, there's a date open in January for a major awards show? Don't mind.
Yeah, I think they're on some cable channel, and I'm sure they'll try to pump it up this year. We'll see. We'll see. It's a shifting landscape. And as we have discussed on the show before, all the award shows need a reimagination. They just need to be rethinking how they give the awards, how they put together a show, because none of them are working anyway. But the Golden Globes are like the biggest disaster zone for sure. Okay, moving on. Ellen DeGeneres, another good topic. The undisputed queen of daytime talk. Whatever happened to Oprah? I guess she's now the queen of daytime talk.
She vacated that throne.
Yes, and left it to Ellen. She's ending her reign. Sorry to cut to the chase, people. The comedian announced this week she's ending her show after this coming season, which is her 19th season on the air. And the announcement comes not long after reports about a toxic culture behind the scenes on the show, which at the time led to the ouster of three of the show's top producers. Ellen, of course, didn't cite that as a reason for ending the show. Instead, she said it just wasn't a challenge anymore, and a bunch of other things, like she was tired of the sound of her own voice. Daniel, are you buying this?
I think it's a nice, convenient thing. She talked about wanting to end it years ago, but having to sign a certain length of contract because of the way TV negotiates with distribution rights. Like, you can't just do a one-year deal. They won't really do that. So I think this was like a very convenient thing for her. Ratings have been going down for years.
Right.
You know, I remember I worked at Telepictures when Ellen launched, and I remember Jim Paratore, rest in peace, the president of the company, saying, you know, the hardest thing to do in television is launch a daytime talk show. It's the hit rate is so minimal. I mean, if you think about it, even in the last few years,
I was just about to say all the Kelly Clarkson and who else is there?
I don't even like Kelly's the only really, I think, successful one in the last, I don't know, 5 or 10. It's a hard thing to do. Mm-hmm. So it'll be curious to see if Kelly is the heir apparent now, or if someone else will take the throne. Drew Barrymore.
That's what I was trying to get.
Yeah, she's been okay, but it's a huge hole for someone to fill, and I'll be very curious to see, you know, leaving the way Ellen did, does that leave a sour taste in other people's mouths? Are they going to be like, do I really want to walk into that? Is that
I totally really doubt it. I think they're going to be like, thank you, goodbye. Don't let the door hit you on the way out. Let me give it a shot. it's too juicy a target for people to be deterred by the fact that, there's this big Me Too culture that has spread into workplace culture and bullying culture and toxic culture kind of conversations. I'm sure, you know, every person can be like, well, that's not going to be a problem for me because I'm so in touch with et cetera. So, and then it was interesting that Ellen today gave an interview to Oprah, or maybe it was at some point this
part of her show.
She talked to Oprah. Yeah. In which she talked about these allegations of toxic culture striking her as misogynistic and unfair. I have no idea. I'm not inside any of your reporting on that. I haven't spoken to any original sources about what went on there. But, you know, toxic culture can be something that has, I think that there's just a bigger conversation. We've talked about that on this show quite a lot, you know, between the Scott Rudin 2 weeks ago and the ICM allegations last week, and now revisiting the Ellen allegations. A lot of this is a matter of degree. Some of it might actually be generational. And in the heat of making, you know, high stakes entertainment or big, you know, level deals, people don't always behave at their best. So
Yeah, and I think this is far from the last we'll hear of Ellen. You know, she's kept very busy. She got back into stand-up in the last few years. She produces a number of shows. She hosts Ellen's Game of Games.
That's true. And she also doesn't have to do another day of work for the rest of her life. She stay up in Montecito and be happy.
She's done pretty well for herself.
Bake cookies and take them down the street to Oprah. Okay.
All right. As always, we like to conclude this first segment with a little something we call Wax On, Wax Off, where we allow our founder and editor-in-chief, Sharon Waxman, the opportunity to speak out about something she is particularly excited about, her Wax On, and maybe something she's a little more upset, angry, feathers ruffled about, maybe, her Wax Off. Mm-hmm. Sharon, as always, the floor is yours.
So this week, my Wax On, Wax Off are about women's empowerment overall. My Wax On has to do with the seventh year we put on, and when I say we, I mean the RAP and our women's division called RAP Women, something called the Be Conference, which is about who do you want to be and how do you become your full potential. It's really about helping to lift up rising talent among women and particularly among diverse women in the industry or those who aspire to be part of this industry. And this is the second year we've done it virtually. We had really amazing speaker, Cynthia Revo, who you're going to hear from soon, was the keynote address there. But we had everything from Padma Lakshmi and Vivica Fox giving workshops to hearing from next gen, stars talking about how they've built their core and their own confidence in driving a career forward. We heard from showrunners like Janet Mock and Susanna Beer. Janet Mock, of course, from Pose, Susanna Beer from The Undoing, a 9-month pregnant Geeta Patel, the director of the new Game of Thrones prequel, that she's about to have a baby and then go direct that in London. I mean, they just blew me away, all of these women. But what most blew me away was the 2,000 women who showed up on our Slack channel to talk to each other and to talk about acting and screenwriting and producing. And it was just mind-blowing to watch that ferment and discussion and excitement and passion. And so bravo to those women, because they're going to grow up and be the next generation of leaders in this industry without any doubt. And then my Wax Off is also related to that. It has to do with women's leadership. I mean, hats off to Liz Cheney, who is incredibly brave in sticking to her principles and refusing to be intimidated, even as she's being ousted from the leadership of the Republican Party in Congress, and basically being told that you are a pariah because you refuse to parrot the lie that Donald Trump either won the election or that Donald Trump had the election stolen from him. And I tip my hat to her. She is going to have a future. The Republican Party, I don't know what future they're going to have, because you cannot build a political party on a foundation of lies, which is what she keeps saying. I have no idea what's going to happen to the Republican Party. And as we've discussed here before, we need two healthy, credible political parties to have a healthy democracy. So that really takes some guts. You might even say it takes some cojones, but I wouldn't say that, because we're talking about female empowerment. And those are my Wax On, Wax Offs. How about you, Daniel?
As always, I like to wax on and wax off about the same thing. We talked about it a little bit already. The Golden Globes, I'm very glad to see them being dismantled and rebuilt. Hopefully, there's no other way to do it. I thought they have long been a joke, and to try and build them back into something a little more credible, I think, is a good idea. But I think everyone waited until it became cool to do it. The allegations against the HFPA came out the week of this year's Golden Globes, and nobody said a word. Right. Everyone accepted their awards happily and went on and waited for other people to give them cover to speak out. And I would have liked to have seen someone take that approach when something actually was on the line, instead of waiting until the awards were over and they collected their stuff and touted their wins.
Are you asking Hollywood to actually do something that's not cynical?
Like, yes,
when
I know.
NBC might not have put its advertising at risk, or all of those shiny statues that the nominees were dying to take home?
I know. I was honestly surprised that night no one turned down the award on the spot. I really thought one person was going to do it. I really did. I guess I was in La La Land, so to speak.
You are in La La Land.
Thinking that would happen. I was hoping against hope that someone would do it, but no one did. And then all of a sudden, everyone comes out and says something when it's cool.
So well, I was thank a little you for pointing that out.
I know. Nothing.
The human condition will disappoint you every time.
Why do we care about award shows? I always do, though. All right, that'll do it for this week's Wax On, Wax Off. When we come back, we'll have Sharon's interview from this year's Bee Conference with the incomparable Cynthia Erivo. Stay tuned.
Cynthia is really one of the most exciting talents to take entertainment by storm in the past several years. For those who don't know her, she started out on stage in The Color Purple as Celie. And since then, she's taken on a wide range of characters, the unflappable Belle in Widows, the mysterious Darlene in Bad Times at the El Royale. And more recently, she's taken on major figures from history. She's played Harriet Tubman, our icon of freedom in the movie Harriet. And now she's embodying the Queen of Soul in the limited series Genius Aretha, playing the one and only Aretha Franklin. So she not only acts, she writes songs, and she sings to shake the roof. We are incredibly excited to welcome her to Rap Women's Bee Conference. But before I bring her out, let's take a look at a trailer for Genius Aretha. And please join me in welcoming Cynthia Erivo.
Hi.
Wow. Well, Cynthia, welcome, welcome.
Thank you very much.
We have so many things we're excited to talk to you about. You have done so much incredible work in recent years. And for our audience who doesn't know, you have won a Tony and an Emmy and a Grammy.
Yes.
And you have two Academy Award nominations from Harriet, both for the song that you wrote and performed, and of course, for that incredible performance. And now we're heading into Emmy season. I don't think there very many people doubt that you will be heavily considered around this unbelievable portrayal, and really deep portrayal of Aretha Franklin. But at this, when you accomplish so many things, it sometimes appears to the outside world as like, oh, it was this kind of incredible, you know, unalloyed journey to success after success. And that's never the case.
No.
And the people at this conference are people who are building their careers in entertainment and media. They're many of them, you know, this is about diversity and inclusion. This is about bringing women into helping them onto their paths. And so, so many of them I know, and me as well, I really want to know how you did it. Like how, what was your path? And so, let's just start if we can a little bit there.
I guess my path is an odd one. I was in London and mostly only doing theater, small theater, regional theater, little bits and pieces like that. And it felt like everything that I did would lead to the next thing. And I would have to work very hard. I would fight. I would audition. I would walk the pavements, get on a bike and get from place to place, get lost on the way to auditions, all of those things, lose out on auditions, not get parts. The main thing is just to keep going and also to keep working and practicing. So, for me, every time I would audition, whether I get it or not, it was another way to learn, another way to meet a character that I might not have met on an ordinary basis, another way to learn something about the way I perform or a skill to pick up when I'm doing, playing someone or trying to tell their story. I think that often we let the nose beat us down, and that's okay for a day or so, and then you have to get up and move forward. If we dwell on the things that we don't get, we never really make the room for the things that we could be working towards getting. And I've had to learn that sometimes the hard way, to be honest. Yeah, even as recent as like this week, I lost out on something that I wanted to do. And you know, there's nothing I can do about that except for let it go. I can sit in it for a little bit and then I move on. It was really disappointing, but I had to let it go because there's other things to get on with. Success doesn't stop you from experiencing no's and the word we use, rejection. I never see it as rejection. I sometimes see it as a way to create some space for yourself so you can keep moving forward towards the thing you're supposed to be doing.
That's incredible to hear. You know, it's a really good reminder, particularly when you're an artist, you constantly have to be putting yourself out there, and you really never get to rest on your Academy Award nominations or wins or Grammys. Or I mean, you should. I'll say you should, but it doesn't really work that way.
No, not at all. And I think that sometimes on the outside, it looks like everything happens and it sort of falls in your
hand. Totally.
That's not how it works. Sometimes when you're lucky, that's if you've done all the work that you need to and you've had conversations with the people that are making the things and it feels right and it all sort of becomes like a kismet, then yes, it happens. I'm also in a really lovely position where I can start to create my own things and create my own work. And that's a whole different ball game, because now it's not just about creating work, it's about creating something that people want to see.
I do want to get to that sort of what you want to create. Let's leave that to side. I want to come back to that in a bit. Let's just start from the beginning. Most of us don't know your story. You're from London. We know that.
London,
your parents are from Nigeria.
Yeah.
So you're basically an immigrant. It's an immigrant story in a way.
I'm first gen Nigerian British. My mother raised me single-handedly. She moved to London when she was, I think, 24, 25.
Why did your mother move?
My mother moved because she wanted more for herself. I think there are parts of Nigeria that have wonderful infrastructure, and there's parts of Nigeria that have terrible infrastructure. She's from a village that really didn't allow her to become all the things that she wanted to. She went to school there, did all the things that she could. I went as far as she possibly could and then wanted more. She really wanted to be a nurse, and there wasn't the space for her to learn the way she wanted to and to be in the field that she wanted to be in. So she essentially got her father to, because she has, I want to say, 7 or 8 siblings.
And wow.
Her father was only sending one of those siblings to London. And she said, well, let me go with her. Let me take care of her, but let me also study. I'll go with her if you let me study as well. And he let her go, but only allowed her to study catering. And she didn't want to study catering. She wanted to study.
Why?
It's
like a tradition or?
Traditional, heteronormative, patriarchal
ideas.
You have to remember, when she came over, it was 60s, 70s. So for her, those are the things that were expected of her, to cook and clean. And she didn't want that. So when she got here, she did the studies for catering whilst learning the subject she needed in order to go and study nursing at the same time. Mm-hmm. So she would go in the daytime to school for catering, and at nighttime she would go to school for nursing. So she would she got her science, her biology, her chemistry, mathematics degrees, and then went and did a nursing degree at King's College on her own, totally on her own. And so I guess that sort of set her up for knowing that stopping someone from doing something that they're meant to be doing it wasn't the right thing to do. So when she had me and she was on her own, she never stopped me from sort of dreaming and being who I wanted to be. I would sing around the house, and there's a baby book that she has. And I think at 18 months, she says, I think she's going to be a singer and an actress. And then when I get to
18 months, what could you possibly be doing at 18 months?
It was I would hum when I was eating. And she just took that as like, okay, this child hums all the time. She's always running around in different clothes and she's humming and singing. And I don't know that that was a natural thing for her to do. So she just noticed it and was like, I think she's going to be a singer or actress. And then maybe later on, because I started mimicking her, she would come home in her nurse's outfit, and mm-hmm. she would be looking at patients and making sure things would get, I would mimic her. I would go and get a little white coat and all of those things and a little white dress and my shoes. And I would use back in London. There's like checking forms where you fill in something that you want to put into the bank. If you've got the cash and you want to check it in and put it in,
right.
You fill out this little form and you give that to the bank. I would use that to pretend to write a prescription.
Oh my gosh. So
I was doing that. So she thought, well, maybe she's going to be a nurse and an actress, nurse or a singer. The acting and the singing never left it, as far as she was concerned. That was what I was meant to do. So as time went on, I did everything I could possibly do. She was never pushy, but she was never in the way. So if I wanted to go and do this at Young Actors Company or this after school club that was just about singing and acting, she would let me go and do those things. When I got to age 15, I did this Young Actors Company with the Young Vic. And at the time, the Young Vic would do young actors' performances of whatever was on in the main house. And what was on in the main house at that time was Romeo and Juliet.
Mm.
It was a Polish circus company doing this production of Romeo and Juliet. And I remember watching it thinking, I cannot believe what I am looking at. It felt like I was watching magic happen in front of me.
Really? And
it was because my brain could not compute how they managed to combine the classical language of Shakespeare with movement and acrobatics. And it just was like, I don't understand what's happening. And I'm watching someone tightrope across the stage and to get to Juliet. I'm watching this man, Romeo, tightrope walk across the stage to get Juliet. And I just was like, my mind is blown. And we did this Young Actors production of that, of Romeo and Juliet, and I played Juliet. And I just remember thinking, everything sort of like dropped in. It felt like this is what I was supposed to be doing.
How old are you at this point?
15.
I was 15.
Yeah.
15. So you were already tapped by the time you're a teenager as like young, real talent, because you're not going to be doing anything at the Vic, okay? The new Vic, old Vic, little Vic, big Vic, I don't care. That is the big time.
Yeah. But for me, I guess I didn't even see it that way, because it was just a short course that we were doing that had let me, it was so strange because I did not intend to get Juliet. I went with a friend to audition because she pulled me in. She said, let's go and do this thing. I think we might have some fun. I want to audition. I think you should come with me and audition as well. So I was like, okay.
This is like a scene from a movie, Cynthia, actually, but go on.
I was like, okay, fine. I don't think anything's going to happen, but we went. And then I get called back the next time because they want me to play Juliet. And I was like, okay.
Your friend must not have been very happy.
My friend did this with me, but she wasn't like a huge character. But I remember feeling a little bit guilty because I really didn't know that I would be picked to do anything like this. You know, yeah.
That's quite a role.
Yes.
To begin your career with.
Yes.
and so then you went on to do, did you, you went to the Royal Academy?
I did. I went on
to Dramatic Arts RADA.
Yes. And that was by default. I, I went to university first to study music psychology, and everyone asks, what's music psychology? Music psychology is the study of the way in which music affects the mind, and often how a person's social standing can also influence that too.
This is how you can be a nurse and a musician.
This is how you can be a psychologist or a counselor and a musician.
You're still holding on to...
I guess in my brain, I was like, I don't know if it's possible for me to be in entertainment, but I certainly would love to be able to help people using music. Mm. So it was like, maybe I'll be a music therapist. Who knows? But because I just didn't think it was possible. But whilst I was doing this course, I was just painfully bored. It's like my brain and my body knew that I was doing the wrong thing. It knew that I was not being stimulated the way I should be. And so I quit because I didn't even need to go to the lectures to give in dissertations. I was passing without even needing to be there, which told me in volumes that I was in the wrong place. So I quit. I go to this youth company at Stratford Theatre Royal, and it's like a short course just for acting and those who want to be in entertainment. And the woman who is the director for the Young Actors Company that I did for the Young Vic is the woman who is taking this youth course at Stratford Theatre Royal. Mm. I meet her in the foyer of the theater, because that's where the course is, and she asks me if I'm training, and I said, what do you mean training? She said, are you going to drama school? I said, no, I'm not going to drama school. I don't think I would get in. She said, well, I think you should go to drama school, and I think you should go to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. I said, and she called it RADA. So when she said RADA, I said, what's RADA? She said, it's the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. I said, I don't think the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts is going to let me in.
And why did you say that?
The Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts. I was like, I'm not getting into a Royal Academy. That's not happening. It's something, you know, when you're a black girl in Southwest London or East London, which is where I was at that time, it's very unlikely that you get into these places. You don't even know they exist. So the idea that you can actually get into somewhere that you didn't know existed is impossible. That I had never even heard of that place before. And to know that there was a place that was Royal Academy, that in my head was like, there's no way, I'm not getting in. So why would I even, I'm not getting in. She said that I couldn't do the course if I didn't apply. Hmm. So she said, come up to my office and apply, or you won't do this course. And I was like, no. She said, well, I'm being really serious. If you don't come up to my office and don't apply to this university and you don't apply to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, you can't come to this course. I was like, fine, I'll apply. We'll see what happens. Out of defiance, didn't apply for anywhere else. I just applied for there. And I got, long story short, I got in. And it's sort of like, shifted the idea of what was possible for me. Mm. Yeah. And to say that, you know, the years at RADA weren't like easy at all, because I think I struggled with trying to both fit in and be myself, and then came to the realization that being myself was probably the best tool I had. Because a lot of drama schools sort of adhere to the break the person down and build them up again. And I actually thought, well, I'd rather just be built up from where I am right now.
You know? So dumb question, mm-hmm. because your singing voice is so extraordinary. It's you have this incredible ability to marry your singing talent with your ability with your acting.
Yeah.
So did you just sing in your spare time? Like, where did that come from?
I had been singing for a really long time, and I was singing.
I know, since 18 months, yes, and we know.
Yeah, I was singing. I was singing in my spare time. I was doing everything from backing vocals to singing at like nightclubs in London. I would be, like, for no money, I would just be like, well, if I can sing, wherever the opportunity presented itself.
Right, right. So you're just doing both at the same time, and you're just honing those skills at the same time. So no eating, sleeping, or drinking, or dating, obviously.
I was running on fumes. I was trying to do as much as I possibly could with what I could do.
Right.
And when we got to RADA, I was lucky enough to bump into a friend who is still a friend today. His name's Michael Pivoy, and he loved musicals. So he would grab all the books from the library that were musical books that had all the songs in them. And we would sneak off to like a room that had a piano in it, and we would sit and we'd sing through all these songs. Mm. And song from shows I had never seen. So we'd learn everything from Sondheim to Stephen Schwartz. We'd like would learn everything. And it was sort of like a space for me to go to express and share what I had within me and hone it all.
Yeah, because that's one of the things that I have sort of in my mind that I wanted to ask you. And but it seems like this is maybe that process is how you could even imagine yourself from where you started to where you are now. And it seems like there's nothing you can't do is what it seems right now. You keep taking on these incredibly ambitious, and I want to talk about Aretha in a moment, and we will. But to me, it's like that's that arc of how when you get to that point and you can see a very different version of your life and what it could look like than what would have been mapped out for you in your own mind,
right?
Like how you imagine yourself into becoming the person step by step that you do. And where, if there was a turning point, and maybe RADA is that turning point for you.
Yes. You know what? There was a moment at RADA that I think was the turning point for me. Two moments. I had a lesson. My acting teacher passed away recently. Her name is Dee Cannon. But she became a really good friend. But she was the one that didn't want me to shy away from who I was internally. Because there is the trope that comes with being a Black woman where you have to play the strong Black woman. And that's what I was playing a lot when we were at RADA. And she would, on purpose, give me the most vulnerable player, the most vulnerable role in whatever we would do. Mm. And she just kept teaching me that vulnerability is your strong suit. That's the thing that makes me want to watch you, because you have a really wonderful way of honing in on the vulnerability of something, of someone, of what they need, what they are. And I had to really come to terms with that, because I had been doing the opposite. I'd been hiding the vulnerability and playing strong, when actually being strong meant being vulnerable for me. And that might not be the story for everyone, but that really was a turning point for me, because I started seeing the way you play characters differently. I started finding out what it is they wanted, what made them, what kept them up in the middle of the night, what was the thing that they didn't want anyone to know, but what was driving them. Mm-hmm. And that makes it far more interesting to play than to do the what's on the outside. Because what's on the outside is obvious, but often what makes that outside tick is what's happening within, where no one can see. So that was one of the moments. And another moment was when at RADA, I wasn't being cast in some of the big roles in like the big productions. Mm-hmm. So again, Michael Pivoy comes along and says, why don't we do like a showcase? So we put the showcase together in the bar with some of the people in our year and some other people who wanted to sing and wanted to just be a part of it. And we put a showcase together for ourselves. And I remember it like it was yesterday. I remember I was wearing this. It was like a little black dress that was flowy and had lots of movement in it. And I did The Miller's Son from Stephen Sondheim. And I jumped on tables and I was moving around the bar, and it was in a bar, but for me, that was my stage. And I everything melted away. I could just be as full as I wanted to be. I could sing, I could act, I could do all of those things as in the way I wanted to. And we invited people to come, and I got my agent that way by just being. And showing who I am fully. And I really didn't have to hide anything. And it was one of the most exhilarating experiences of my life. And I think it really just, it told me that when you're fully yourself and when you're fully dropped in, you're open and people can see you.
That's amazing. That's amazing that it was that moment of crystal clarity.
Yeah.
For you, that you connected to your art or to your muse, and that's the place you want to go as an artist.
Yeah.
But the thing is to go there again and again.
Yeah.
And be vulnerable, as you say. Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. So let's talk about Aretha, which is it's really all you. I mean, you're probably in every scene except for the ones where there's a lovely, beautiful little girl who's playing Aretha as a child.
Yeah,
you can remind us her name because
Cheyenne. She's amazing.
She sings beautifully too. Before we talk about it, I'd like to just show a quick clip.
Yes.
We looked at it at the trailer before, but this is just another small clip from Aretha. Let's all take a look. They don't know that I would leave you if I could. Guess I'm uptight. That I'm stuck like glue. Cause I ain't never
loved a man the way that I love you.
So that is you, Cynthia, singing as Aretha, as you do throughout the series. Tell us how you felt taking on, for starters, this role.
I felt, one, it was a huge honor to be asked to do it, because she's one of my heroes. She's one of the people who taught me what it was to tell a story through song, not just to sing it.
Yeah.
And then there was sort of this overwhelming sense of responsibility. I wanted to be able to tell this story, not just about the music that she made, but about the person behind it all, about the things that she had gone through that made her who she was and made her able to tell stories the way she did, to sing music the way she did, because I think sometimes we
write it
and find the bravery to want to be credited the way she was credited. The first time she was credited for as a producer on her album was during the Amazing Grace, for Amazing Grace, and I think it was 1976. I may be wrong, but it's definitely late 70s. And I think that we take for granted often who the woman was. We know it was the Queen of Soul. We know that her music is incredible. We know her voice is incredible. But we don't realize where all of that comes from. And I think that I felt the responsibility, and I had the need to tell the story about the woman. Because I think that story is really important, that we don't see. I guess I always want to make sure that we see each of the women that I play as full people, not just as who they were in front of the cameras or what they did, but as fully realized human beings who had life and who were moving through life to give the things that they were giving.
Yeah, but she's a very complicated person.
Yes,
coming fair. From the church. Her relationship with her father, her relationship with the rest of her family. They were all very gifted musically, coming up in the church, and then deciding, I'm not going to be in the church. I'm going to do I'm going to be who I am, which really was quite radical.
It was very radical. And I think it took her some time to find what her place was, and it actually took her moving back to the church and pulling from the things that she knew and learned from there and bringing it into the now, putting it into the music that she would sing. to find out who she was, you know? And I think that that is a radical thing to, and it's a fearless thing to do, because people already expect something of someone like her who comes from the church to stay that way. But if that's not your place, if that's not where you can send out your message, or that's not where you can tell your stories, then it's okay to move. It doesn't mean that you don't believe anymore. It just means that this, your calling is something different.
Yeah.
To look into that is brave.
Yeah, I did. I didn't actually know until I saw the series that her father was such a famous minister and such a force in his own right, and that, you know, so much of what she had to do was in reference to him.
Yes.
You know,
yes,
throughout her life. It was absolutely fascinating and a great performance as well. Yeah, yeah. What came first for you when you were taking on a character? Very few people can sing Aretha credibly, and you have to sing it, you know, as Aretha. It's not like, oh, this is Cynthia Erivo's take on Aretha Franklin. You're actually trying to credibly. Well, first of all, the singing is just extraordinary. And so where did you start? Did you start taking apart the character, or did you start sort of practicing, how am I going to sing like Aretha Franklin, as Aretha Franklin?
I think it started from the character. It started from the person. You know, it's listening to the recordings, listening to the choices that she made, listening to interviews and the way she would speak, because she has a certain cadence that's slightly different, and that changes over time as she gets more confident. The way she speaks changes, and when she's singing, I've been listening to her for such a long time that I noticed that there are like tricks that she would have that nobody else would really notice. There are times when, yes, she's full voice and it's big. There are other times where it sounds that way, but actually she's doing almost nothing. It's like a, it's pulled back and it's quieter than you think it is. And just listening to those choices that really actually helped me to figure out how to use my voice to sing her songs. There's only one Aretha Franklin, and only one person can sound like Aretha Franklin because she's Aretha Franklin. But there are, there was the choice I made was to try and find the nuances and the breath, the choices, that she, the trills, the pauses, the way she would say a certain word, the lilt on a word. Maybe she would go from one note and glide into another in different songs, and that's sort of the things that I was listening to, all the details. The details for me were really helpful. I had a wonderful teacher in Antea Joy Bichette who would sit with me, and we would listen to songs for hours, just breaking it down, working through each little phrase, and just going back and adding, going back and adding, and listening, because that was really the only way to do it. But when you start, I think that when you start finding out who she is and learning who she is at certain times, the music drops in as well.
Ah.
Yeah. When you know who, when you start to discover who she is,
yes,
music makes so much more sense.
Yeah. I read somewhere that you got to meet Aretha Franklin.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So the first time I met her was after a show, which was, I was doing The Color Purple, and she'd come to see the show.
On Broadway.
On Broadway, and I didn't know she was there. And I came down, and someone said, Aretha Franklin is downstairs and would like to meet you. So I come downstairs, and sure enough, there's Aretha Franklin standing there. And as I walk towards her, she sings the last line of the big song in the show, which is, I'm here.
Yeah. And
I just was astounded, because this is a woman who doesn't have to spend her time doing anything she doesn't want to. And the fact that she stayed and listened and watched the show was kind of incredible. I half think that it was because of Jennifer at that point, because I know that they have a relationship and
Jennifer Hudson.
Yes. And Jennifer was in the show at that time. Mm-hmm. But she stayed to meet everyone, and it was really wonderful. And I took a picture with her, and then I met her again at the Kennedy Center Honors. And they had asked me to come and sing something to commemorate the centennial of I think it's opening, so for John F. Kennedy, and I was singing The Impossible Dream. And I met her just before I started performing, and she remembered who I was from The Color Purple. So that would
be my cool.
That was really cool. I met her. She was there with Clive Davis, and they were together. And I was just like, this is mind-blowing. Okay. And so we get to the performance, and I didn't realize this, but when I watched the performance back, they pan to Aretha, and she's singing along with me. Her eyes are closed, and she's in the air. And it's one of my favorite things, and I still have that little recording because it is sort of like a pat on the shoulder, like, well done, you dug it.
Oh my goodness.
Her singing along to me singing The Impossible. I was like, what? Where do they do that?
I saw a clip last night. I was looking up some clips of you and saw your mother with you at the Tonys.
Yeah.
What does she say to you now?
You know, I had a really lovely conversation with her. I felt like it was maybe a year ago. We were in my little apartment in New York, and she was looking at, I had a bookshelf there, and I put my awards on it. So my Tony was there, the Grammy was there, the Emmy was there, and she was looking at it. And she said, because I try and fly her out wherever I am. So she's been to everywhere. So if I've done a show in Japan, she's come out to Japan. I took her out to Japan, and she's come out to LA, she's come to New York. And she said, I never thought that I would have seen all the places that I've seen. Thank you for taking me with you to these places. Thank you for showing me all these places. And and she always sends me off with a prayer, always. She's like, I hope, she always sends this prayer, regardless of where I am. She is always like, I pray that you have many more blessings and much more abundance in your life. And it always means something, because I think sometimes it drops in to her where she started, where she got to, and where I am right now.
Yeah.
I think it's sort of like I did well. And I always remind her that I'm okay. Like, she doesn't have to worry about me anymore, mm-hmm. you know? And I tell her that over and over again, because she's, you know.
She worried about you?
She's always worried about me. She can't help it. And I think that the first time she sort of relaxed and went, oh, my daughter's okay, is when we had that conversation where she said, well, thank you. I never thought I would see all these places. So, it's a wonderful thing to know that you can give something back to your mother, to your parent, when they didn't expect it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We talk in this event, we talk a lot about mentorship and mentors, and you've mentioned a couple of people, yeah. teachers, yeah. or this woman who basically forced you to apply to RADA. I don't know if she was formally a mentor, but she's somehow formative for you. But would you say that your mother is your biggest mentor? Like, who is your most important mentor, would you say?
My mother is one of my biggest mentors. I have this group of women who have throughout my life been able to push me forward and just keep helping. And whether it be one piece of advice they give me or just a conversation they have. So my mother is a mentor. The woman who helped me get into drama school, Ray McKen, Dee Cannon, who is my acting teacher. I would say Oprah is a mentor. I remember I got
From The Color Purple, obviously.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But I remember I got an email from her because I had taken on so much. I was going to everything and doing everything, and I was running on fumes. And she said, I noticed that you're going to a lot of these things. You know, you can say no. And I took it to heart. I took it to heart because I am a person that's like, if it's coming towards you, you can say yes to everything, but you don't have to say yes to everything. Mm-hmm. And if it's supposed to come around again, it will come around again.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so I've had to learn that. And I'm still learning that, because things will come up along and I'm like, oh, I think I want to do that. And I have to remind myself, you are only one person. Do the things you can do now. And whatever you can't do will come around again if it's supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a huge learning curve for me. I think most of the women in my life, my best friend, who is not a woman, his name is Capri, and he's very good at reminding me of my worth. He loves me for everything I am. We've known each other for almost 16 years. So he knew me before all of this. And he's still there when I need him. You know, I was in London.
Why do you say that you would even need someone to remind you of your worth? I mean, you've shown everyone because what you can do.
I think sometimes I downplay the things I've been able to achieve. I sometimes minimize what's happening, and often that's just sort of a survival technique because it keeps you going. If you stop and look at the bigness of the things that are going on, it sometimes can be overwhelming. But he often is the person to go, no, Cynthia, this happened. What are we really just going to skate past this thing that happened because it's actually incredible? So should we just take a moment to look at it, please? I'm going to. And he'll just pull me up in that way. But at the same time, he'll allow me to still sometimes be like the regular girl that was from East London. And we'll go out and we'll chill out and we'll, you know, have some food in the house and wear our sweats and we'll be like us. And I love that. I love that about him because he allows me to be all of the things that I am. So this person with you and then the regular easygoing person from London. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, what other things do you want to do in your career? Are you interested in continuing to play the kind of iconic roles from history? I couldn't believe, by the way, when you did Harriet, that like there hadn't already been a movie about Harriet. I think that's something I discussed with your director Casey at the time.
Yeah, there had only been a TV movie and a series and a couple episodes in a series.
Not enough. And yeah. And you know, Aretha. This year, there's two projects on Aretha actually with your friend Jennifer Hudson, right?
Which is wonderful and necessary. I do want to play more iconic characters, but it's not. I don't chase them. They sort of, if they come and they're right, then I want to do them. Mm-hmm. But more than anything, I want to keep playing roles that you might not see a woman like me in often because we exist, you know, like whether it might be the woman who's an espionage expert who happens to be a spy or it might be a track racer or it might be someone who is just, you know, a mother trying to make it through, or it might be a woman who's hopelessly in love, or it could be a superhero, or it could be Sarah Forbes Bonetta, which is what I think one of the projects that we're doing, who was, for all intents and purposes, a princess. It could be anything, just as long as it gives me the space to introduce a woman in the fullest way possible. That is what I want to play.
Mm. And you said that you're starting to think about producing, or are you starting to produce?
I'm starting to produce. I have a company, Edith's Daughter. We have a very full slate. So hopefully in the next year or so, some of those projects will be, you know, on your screens and coming to fruition. And
so whether you're playing the main role or not.
Yeah. And that's really a wish of mine, to be able to create things that I don't have to be in, that I can create space for other people.
And why is that? Why is that important to you?
Because I don't think there's enough, there isn't enough yet for faces that look like mine. And I want to be one of those spaces that they can come to, you know? And I get to play in this world, and I want to use the space that I've been given to give to others, you know? I think it's important. There's no point going forward and up if you can't reach back and go, hey, come with me. And that's what I want to do.
Well, Cynthia Erivo, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing so candidly your past, your present, your hopes for the future. You're truly an inspiring person. And I want to thank you for the performances that you've given us, which get to live forever.
Thank you.
But also thank you for just sharing with us today, the person behind all those performances. I think it's wonderful for us to learn from you and to understand all the layers that come with that success. It's quite inspiring. Thank you for being at the B Conference.
Thank you very much, Sharon. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
And that's it for this week's episode of The Wrap-Up. Thank you to all of our listeners. And remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. And be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.